Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
More than 160,000 of the state's oldest residents will become eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine starting Monday, February 8th. That week will mark the first time Oregonians who are 80 or older and living independently may receive the immunization. Those who are older and more infirm are far more susceptible to serious complications and death from the coronavirus, something that has been known since the pandemic hit the state almost 1 year ago. The risks of those 80 and older are particularly frightening. While representing only about 4% of Oregon's population, that group accounts for well over half the state's deaths from COVID-19, 1,041 of the 1,991 as of Wednesday. Yet Governor Kate Brown last month placed educators and child care staff ahead of seniors when vaccine supplies from the federal government proved to be less than advertised. School staff became eligible for the immunizations on January 25th, a full 2 weeks ahead of the oldest and most vulnerable Oregonians. The governor defended the difficult decision she made, citing the educational and emotional impacts the long-term school closures have had on students and families. Still, her course made Oregon one of the only states in the country that had not yet begun inoculating at least some of their oldest and most vulnerable residents based on age groups, despite supply limitations and other challenges that have been common to all. After those 80 and older, other older Oregonians will become eligible in subsequent weeks, with the plan to make the vaccine available to everyone 65 and older by the end of February. Shots for those 75 to 79, an estimated 134,000 people, will start February 15th. 70 to 74, 206,000 on February 22nd, and 65 to 69, 258,000 on March 1st. More than 500,000 residents are currently eligible for the vaccine, including the 105,000 educators and support staff, and nearly 370,000 have received at least one dose of the two-shot series, according to the latest numbers from the state. To find out when and where you can get the shot or confirm your eligibility, visit covidvaccine.oregon.gov. Text ORCOVID to 898211 or email ORCOVID at 211info.org. Bill Kenemer might be forgiven for feeling a bit like the Godfathers these days. Just when he thought he was out, they pull him back in. Kenemer, a longtime Canby area resident, retired from the Oregon legislature in 2018 after nearly a decade serving House District 39. Also, a former state senator and Clackamas County Commissioner, Kenimer, 74, declined to seek re-election 3 years ago and likely believed his time as a public servant had come to a close. But fate had something else in store. When State Senator Alan Olson, also from Cambie, abruptly resigned last month, Kenimer was one of nearly a dozen local conservatives to submit their names for consideration. And as the only one with prior elective experience in the legislature, he soon rose to the top of the pile. On Monday, Clackamas and Marion County commissioners met in joint session to consider Kenimer and two other finalists to fill Olson's unexpired term. All three performed well and received praise from the elected officials and public commentators alike. But at the end of the day, most commissioners signaled that they favored Kenimer. His prior experience, given the serious challenges facing the state and the fact that the appointee must assume the office in the middle of a legislative session, seemed to push him over the top. That he had served during previous statewide appointment and redistricting periods, which happened every decade following the census, was a particular mark in his favor, according to several commissioners. After the vote, Commissioner Paul Savas acknowledged the extraordinary difficulty of the decision, saying he knew, liked, and trusted all three men. "Bill, congratulations," Savas said, then adding with a laugh, "You better get working." Fred Gilrod, leader of the Republican caucus in the Senate, who welcomed Kenimer back to the fold with a statement Monday evening. "We welcome Bill back to the Senate," Gilrod said. "He has been a faithful public servant for his community and will provide important leadership on the most pressing issues of our time. Wildfire recovery, getting help to our small businesses and working families, getting schools reopened, and an effective pandemic response." The Cambie City Council, in its role as the Urban Renewal Agency, last month approved matching grants for facade improvements at two pivotal downtown properties, the former Parsons Building and the Holly Mall, which houses Pappy's Greasy Spoon, the Panaderia Oaxaca, and other businesses. Both projects will involve cleaning and repainting the exterior masonry. The Holly Mall is also replacing signage and exterior light fixtures, while the new owner of the Parsons Building, Caldera International, is reinstalling double doors and windows on the Grant Street side of the property. The doors and windows will serve a suite intended for Cambie's independent bookstore, the Book Nook, which is expected to move in later this month. Cambie Economic Development and Tourism Coordinator Calvin Lesueur noted the Holly Mall's application was particularly strong because it has several vacancies, most of them highly visible storefronts on Northwest 2nd Avenue. The city hopes the facelift, coupled with private investment, will help make the mall more inviting for customers, residents, and potential tenants. Both requests were approved unanimously. The city's facade improvement program provides grants of up to $25,000 with matching funds required from the property owner. The program has funds to accommodate approximately three projects per year, depending on the size of requests. Previous beneficiaries of the program include Bricks and Minifigs, Cambie Station, the former Cambie Herald Building, Countryside Living, and Ebner's Custom Meats. For photos, find the story on our website at cambiefirst.com. If you're in the market for a restored airplane wing or two-story tall vintage posters, you'll soon have a place to shop for one. Aurora Mills Architectural Salvage's new 8,000 square foot retail display and sales floor is taking shape, and owner Mike Burns is hopeful the new space will be open by this summer. The new space will specialize in the display of large items that don't easily fit into the existing sales floor. Back bars, theater lighting, airplane wings, even a 20-foot poster advertising a carnival giant. "I like to joke that we could fit a double-decker English bus in here, Burns quipped. The company will continue to use the iconic mill in much of the same fashion as it has since it opened as a commercial space in 1999. The original mill building is a historic landmark, and we will continue to operate our retail shop in that building as well as the new building, Burns said. The new space is modeled after the design aesthetic of historic 19th century train sheds, appropriate considering the neighbor railroad tracks, and is meant to complement the existing mill. The new structure replaces a World War II Army surplus Quonset hut that had occupied the space since 1948. A buyer in Seattle, Washington area intended to rebuild the hut there to display vintage vehicles from World War II era and other memorabilia. At the time the project was greenlighted, it was just the second new commercial structure to be planned in the city of Aurora in the past 50 years, the first being Filbert's Farmhouse Kitchen. Steve Puga, owner of the FOB Tap Room, did not get into the hospitality business to fill growlers and send his customers and friends on their way. But the early months of the pandemic left him little choice. Without a kitchen or even video lottery machines to fall back on, the FOB had even fewer options than many restaurants, pubs, and other watering holes that at least could offer takeout food and drinks while the coronavirus forced them to keep their tables empty. Nowadays, things are looking a little more normal at the FOB, if anything can be considered normal during COVID. The TVs are on, the music is playing, the bar is open, it's just outdoors. The outdoor bar, which opens to the tap room via a roll-up door, has been a big hit, Puga says, and it's something he's been wanting to do for some time, even before COVID. I was born and raised in Portland. Don't hold that against me, he jokes, but I wanted to have something like this, an outdoor two-sided bar, and thankfully we were able to get this done in the summertime and have it available for customers. The FOB has also taken advantage of the Open Air Camby Recovery Program, an economic development initiative allowing businesses to expand their operations into parking lots and streamlining the process for installing tents and other outdoor coverings. Puga invested a 15 by 15 foot tent with a high peak roof to increase circulation and airflow. I wanted to make sure that there was a ton of air going through, Puga said. My wife's a nurse, so we were really aware of that. We tell people it's windy, it's cold, because we're trying to keep everyone safe. The months the FOB was limited to growler service only was a difficult time, Puga admits. Not just financially, but emotionally. He watched his normally busy tap room sit still and quiet day after day. But on a chilly January afternoon last week, Puga was all smiles, even as a light snow began to fall. It was not exactly a day that makes folks long for a cold beer, yet a dozen or so patrons had turned up to sip in the FOB tent or get a growler filled. They're here because they care, he said. Every day I'm here, and I thank them personally. I love this place, and if it wasn't for them, we honestly wouldn't be here. That's not an exaggeration. It's absolutely true. It's been tough, but we appreciate the community support. For photos from this story, visit canbefirst.com or follow us on Facebook and Instagram at CanbyCurrent.
Stay connected to what matters most this winter with unlimited high-speed internet from DirectLink. While things may look a little different this year, as we all work together to keep everyone as safe and healthy as possible, you can be confident that DirectLink's reliable network will keep your video calls, Snapchats, stories, and photos crystal clear and at your fingertips whenever you need them. In 2021, DirectLink is thankful for all of their amazing members and is proud to be your local internet, video, and voice provider for over 116 years. Okay, joining us in the Camby conversation today is, we have a real treat. We are joined by Jamie Emerson. She is from here originally, but is now on the other side of the world. Hi, Jamie, how are you?
I'm going well, thanks. How are you, Tyler?
Very good to hear. I was doing great. Tell us a little bit about who you are and your situation out there. You are a student in New South Wales, Australia?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I grew up in Canby, moved to Sydney about 3 years ago, and I'm currently studying a Bachelor's of Information Technology at Australian Catholic University, which is located in Sydney, Australia. And New South Wales is the state where Sydney is located.
Right. So you've been out there for a couple of years, you said?
Yes, 3 years.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you were recently, and what kind of got us in contact and prompted this interview, is you were honored as the International Student of the Year for that state. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I went to a ceremony in early December for this award called the New South Wales International Student of the Year Award, and I won in the higher education category. So that was really cool, and it was really in recognition of the work that I've done with the charity organization that I've started here called Chronic Hope, as well as the work I've done with women in the STEM fields to empower them and allow them to have mentorship opportunities, as well as various other projects that I'm working on.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah. I'd love to, before we discuss more of that and what life is like for you right now, I'd love to hear just a little bit more about growing up in Canby, what that was like, and what kind of led you to some of the amazing stuff that you've been able to do.
Yeah, no worries. You guys might hear my Aussie sayings or accents coming out a little bit in this podcast. So I grew up on Central Point Road. Well, part of my childhood on Aspen Street, kind of in downtown Canby or that area. And then we moved out to the country on Central Point Road. Youngest of five kids, Stephen, Christy, Emerson are my parents. And I was also homeschooled, so not as much in the Canby school system, but we were quite involved in various churches in Canby. And I also worked at the Place to Be Cafe when that was kind of opened. Exactly. It's interesting. I'm not going to lie. It's really interesting because I have lived overseas 6 out of the last 8 years. So I moved to Paris when I was 19 and lived there for 3 years, came back to the US for 2, and then moved to Sydney. So I've been here for 3 years. So it's interesting because I've been away for so long, I've developed this sort of like external mindset around Canby and my upbringing and all of that. And it's very different than the rest of the world, even in terms of just living out in the country. And my family has, you know, does recreational shooting and that sort of thing, and it's very common. But yeah, it was really good. I enjoyed growing up in the country, and I was also afforded opportunities as a homeschooler to then go to community college when I was in high school. So I was able to get the first 2 years of university or college done when I graduated high school. So that was really cool. And I loved working at the Place to Be because that was probably my first experience really getting to know the downtown community, like the Canby community. And I was working there when I decided to move to Paris, and the community was so supportive of me. I told everyone, and I had we had customers coming in and congratulating me or buying me gifts, or the Wells Fargo next to that building, they bought me this bouquet of flowers and it's very much this small town community feel. And I love that. I think that was hard to leave.
Yeah.
But and it was hard to leave, and because I was very much appreciated and cared for in that community. But I ever since I was in high school, I've always had a desire to live overseas. And that has never gone away. So me moving to Paris was very much fulfilling that desire, and the community was very supportive of that as well.
Yeah.
In terms of like, Jamie, you need to go live your life. You need to go, like, Canby's always going to be here. Canby's always going to be the same.
Yeah.
Go live your life. And so that was really, I remember someone had told me that, and I was like, okay, like, that's, it's letting go of this. And yeah, and so I lived in Paris. I moved back to the US, as I said, for 2 years because I got diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. So I spent a season living with my parents again and figuring out from a medical perspective what that looked like to heal, recover, get better from that. And then when I was well enough, I moved to Sydney. So yeah, that's where I'm at now.
That's really cool. It's awesome to hear how supportive you felt from our town and that big life decision that you made. I guess I heard you say that Parisians don't do a lot of recreational shooting. That's something that's
no,
not big
Parisians,
over there.
Neither Parisians nor Australians.
Okay. Fair enough. Maybe they'll catch on later.
Yeah.
You said that you had always wanted to live abroad, but it was actually here in Canby at the place to be that you decided France and Paris. What led you to pick that locale?
Yeah, so when I was in high school, I was studying at community college, at Clackamas Community College, and I studied 2 years of French language, and I was part of the French club there, and they sent me on a trip to Paris. Oh. And at the time, my sister was living there, so I stayed with her, and she was just there for a year teaching English. And I came home, and I just decided that I was going to move to Paris, and it was just that. I was 18, I think, at the time, and trying to figure out what the next step looked like for my life. And I kind of knew that I didn't really want to stay in Canby in the longer term. So yeah, Paris. And what drove me really was I wanted to become bilingual in French and English. So I did that. I moved there. I became bilingual. I studied there for about a year and a half before I got chronic fatigue syndrome. So I was fully studying in French. I was studying a bachelor's of economics. And then also I did some nannying and worked there as well. So I think it was just a natural progression of what I was already studying.
Yeah. Yeah. What were some of the big changes that you noticed? Not just a completely new culture and language over there, but a huge international city as opposed to a small town like Canby.
Yeah, first thing, it's very diverse, ethnically diverse in Paris.
Yeah.
Whereas in Canby, it's not, you don't get a lot of non-white people.
Yeah.
Don't
hear a lot of
which people. I love.
You really don't.
I mean, even in Oregon as well, it's very,
it's
not very diverse. And so I think living in Paris really exposed me not only to French culture, but also different cultures like African cultures, Asian cultures, all different types of cultures that I had never experienced before because I didn't grow up in that type of environment. And I found that really beautiful and amazing and valuable, because one thing I learned in that is that it's just like it's so good to open your mind to different cultures and different perspectives. You might not agree, but having that conversation, that dialogue with people from different cultures, different backgrounds, opens your mind, or at least it did mine. And I found that so valuable because then I was able to see things differently or get new ideas or get different perspectives, which enabled me to move forward better in my life.
Yeah. That's cool. And I feel like when you make a decision like you did to leave your comfort zone and go to a new place, you become much more open to that kind of stuff. Whereas if, say, a French person or someone from another culture did come to visit Canby, it may not have that same impact on you, where you're kind of still in your comfort zone in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there was actually a French exchange student, I think, during my last year that I was here, who I got to know quite well.
Yeah.
His name was Nicolas Bouffenois, and we became really good friends. And I'm sorry?
That was beautifully pronounced.
Oh, thank you. I think he really helped as well inspire me to move to France, because we became quite close. I didn't speak French at the time, but we would hang out a lot, and it made me realize how much I really did want to move.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. And I was also 19 when I moved.
Right.
So at that age, you're exploring the world. I mean, your brain is still developing. You're still learning about how to become an adult and all of that. So it was a really good time to move.
What did people over there think of you and your background and your American culture? Were people interested in that? Was it not a big deal?
Yeah, they were actually. It's interesting because a lot of, I think, Americans get the impression that French don't like Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But because I spoke French, I was very well received. Nice. I think it's usually the Americans that don't speak French, they get kind of annoyed at.
Yeah, I can see that.
But I was very well received just because I did speak French and I made a lot of effort to learn the language.
That's cool.
Yeah, I think it was just, I think the cultural differences are interesting. Like, again, coming from small town America, where you have a certain mentality to France, where it's a completely different government system. It's completely different mindset. So there's a lot of, you know, conversations around that sort of thing.
Yeah. It's really interesting, especially where you know, America kind of has that history and that reputation as being a melting pot. But when you really get down to it, especially into small towns, like you say, in your experience, we do tend to be a lot more homogenous, right? And I think that's something that you don't see as much in really big cities like you say in Paris.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you came back home because of a condition that you noticed, the chronic fatigue syndrome, which led you to found this Chronic Hope, a really cool organization. Tell us a little bit about your work with that and how your personal experience with this condition led you to that.
Yeah, totally. So I was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome after a car accident that I got in when I was in the US. So I was living in Paris at the time, but I was in the US on holiday. We're on vacation, and we got in a pretty bad car accident with my dad, my mom, and then my two sisters. Mm-hmm. And about 3 months after that, I started getting chronic pain and chronic fatigue.
Mm.
It was a really bad accident. The car was completely totaled, flipped a couple times. I mean, it was out on the Molina Road, and we were going like 55 miles per hour.
And you're still.
Yeah, I was, again, the Aussie coming out of me.
55 kilometers would not be that fast, right?
No, 55 kilometers, probably more like 35 miles per hour, 37 miles per hour.
Anyway.
So, yeah. I went back to Paris. I started getting chronic pain, got quite sick, and I had to make the decision. It was it's probably one of the hardest decisions I had made in my life up to that stage of moving back to the US from Paris, because I didn't want to come back to America. I wanted to stay.
Sure.
But I was so unwell, I couldn't work. I was studying at the time and wasn't doing well in my studies. Chronically fatigued, chronic pain. I came back to the US and I started seeing a naturopath who then diagnosed me with chronic fatigue syndrome. And I was 23 at the time. So I'm 28 now. So it was about 5 years ago. And it was honestly the most devastating thing that I've probably, one of the most devastating things I've probably experienced, because I was, I was housebound for around 6 months, like severely ill, chronic pain.
Yeah.
And the thing with chronic fatigue syndrome is the recovery rate's 5%, and they don't really know what causes it, and they don't really know how to cure it.
Yeah.
So it's very complex. And at the time, I didn't really have access to a lot of resources around CFS recovery. And my family didn't really have a lot of understanding around CFS. So there wasn't as much support from that perspective as well. And we were all kind of just trying to figure, I was trying to figure out what it looked like to get better, because I decided that I wasn't going to let that be something that affected me for the rest of my life. When I read the statistic, when I went online, I Googled chronic fatigue syndrome, and everybody says there's no hope, there's no options, there's no resources. And I just read it and I said, no, I'm going to be one of the 5%. I'm going to do everything I can to recover. And so I spent a season just living at home, and I did my yoga and I changed my lifestyle. I changed my diet. I started seeing a naturopath. There was then some like roots to the illness and all of that. And it was a really hard journey. It was really hard. There were moments where I was in pain, and along with the fatigue, and there were moments where I wanted to give up and I wanted to stop living and being in pain because it was so hard.
So sorry.
But I kept going.
Yeah.
And because I just had that hope, I held on to the hope that I was going to recover, and it was gradual, but I did. And then I moved to Sydney, and I still had chronic fatigue at this time. And I just was like, I want to move to Sydney because I'm dreaming about that. And if my health crashes, I'll move back and that'll be that. Mm-hmm. But when I arrived, everything kind of worked out for me. I got a job, place to live within like 3 weeks. And yeah. And then I sort of had this dream in the middle of the night where I just felt like I needed to start this organization to help people with chronic illness. And this was very shortly after I arrived in Sydney. And it was like, you need to start this organization called Chronic Hope. You need to help build community for people with chronic illness. And you need to call it Chronic Hope. And I call it a God drop because that's like my faith. But I woke up the next morning and I was like, that's it. That's what I'm meant to be doing with my life. and I think that came from having been in such a terrible place,
yeah,
physically and mentally. Now that I was starting to come out of it, I was like, I have to do something for people that are in this place because it's so hopeless. And I don't want people to be sitting there thinking that they're alone when they're not.
Right.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was gonna go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate and we got in a carriage ride with the horse and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it sounds like from your story, that was a big part of the emotional difficulty of it, was even your family, who had been through that accident with you, but weren't experiencing the same things that you were, and just feeling that lack of understanding, right? That they didn't really know what was going on. You didn't know what was going on. That's got to be something with chronic hope that you found to be really valuable for people, I would imagine. That community of understanding.
Yes, exactly. So that was one of the big things that I wanted to create. And so Chronic Hope is essentially an organization that offers health and wellness resources to the chronic illness community. And so we're a registered nonprofit and charity organization in Australia. And we primarily do this in three or four ways. We're working on some different projects, but we have a podcast that comes out weekly. Mm-hmm. We have an Instagram that has a community of around 1,000 people that have joined, of people that are living with chronic illness. And they all share stories and tips around living with chronic illness, dealing with symptoms, etc. We also have a blog, and then we also release original Chronic Hope music, which is really geared towards helping the community be able to even just listen to music when they're in those moments where they feel a little bit hopeless. Yeah. Or a lot hopeless.
That's really cool. Your podcast, tell us a little bit about that. Do you invite other people from the community on to share their stories and things like that?
Yeah, I love the podcast because I've ended up being able to meet people from all over the world. I've interviewed people in the UK, in Canada, in the US, in Australia, in I'm trying to think if there's any other countries, like lots of different people from all over the world. And I get people on, we talk about different topics.
Yeah.
So topics around like working with a chronic illness, topics around having relationships, friendships, navigating the medical system. And what you kind of see is that a lot of people have similar stories and journeys. They're different, but they're also similar. So even if you don't have chronic fatigue, for example, or you have another chronic illness, a lot of the same resources help the whole community because it's very similar.
Yeah.
In the way that symptoms manifest.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool. About how many people suffer from chronic illnesses? Do you have a percentage or roughly?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's actually crazy. Most people don't know this. So 50% of Australians have a chronic condition. So this includes anxiety, depression, cancer, arthritis, a wide range of chronic conditions. The statistic in the US is 70% of Americans live with a chronic condition.
Yeah.
And then 30% of adults worldwide struggle with multiple chronic conditions. So essentially it's something that affects billions of lives. And it's kind of this underlying thing that I think not a lot of people have that awareness that it's such this massive issue.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting with COVID because I've been aware of this issue for a while because of my own experience. And part of the reason why I started Chronic Hope is because I felt that this was going to be the issue that was going to arise in a couple of years, and that people are going to start to kind of realize that one of the biggest crisis facing our economies, if you look at the burden on the healthcare system, both in Australia, it's actually this mental health, physical health issues, and COVID's really bringing that out.
Right. The mental health thing, you might even call it a pandemic.
Yeah. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And I've even had people message me on the Chronic Hope Instagram saying I had COVID and now I have chronic fatigue syndrome because chronic fatigue results from a lot of times from a virus.
Yeah.
And it's like, what do I do? What's next for me? And unfortunately with the virus, I think especially in the US, not as much in Australia because the cases are so low here. Unfortunately, we might start seeing a lot of people with health conditions coming out of this pandemic. And what are we doing to support those people? So that's my passion, is how do we support these people? We're working on starting a scholarship program for people to actually get free healthcare or free mental health care and free therapy appointments through Chronic Hope, and then branching out into other sorts of healthcare options because that healthcare is expensive and you get in this vicious cycle of you can't work because you're sick, but you can't get better because you don't have the money to pay for treatment. And our goal is to help people get out of that cycle and offer resources with at different touch points as well.
Yeah. So what has life been like out there with COVID? You hear sort of like New Zealand and Australia, and you mentioned the cases have been a lot lower. And at least now life is relatively normal there, is kind of what you hear, at least compared to some of the places where it's harder to hit, like here in the parts of the US.
Yeah.
Is that the case, or do you have periods where things kind of locked down and then got past it? Or what was your experience like out there?
Yeah, so Australia's been very, people ask me about it. It's actually really hard to compare because it's so different.
Yeah.
It's like there's almost just no way to be like, make a comparison if you put them close to each other. But
the brag, Jamie, all right? Like, no.
No. This is what I'm trying to say is it's completely different. I mean, it's the society is different. The politics are different. The mindset is different. So we were in lockdown for about 6 weeks from March to May or June. And then we kind of came out of that. And since it's been pretty normal.
Yeah.
Like we can't do big events. In my state, we've kind of gone up and down, but it's been like maximum 23 cases since the beginning of June
per day.
In the last week or so, we've had zero cases in New South Wales.
Yeah.
So it's different. So even we had an outbreak. I'm like putting my, I don't know what this is called.
People the can't air see quote. This. Yeah.
The air quote. We had an outbreak.
Yeah.
Because I think you guys will think it's cute.
Yeah.
We had an outbreak of like in this part of Sydney where we had started getting like 23 cases a day and like the whole region went into lockdown. Everyone had to start wearing masks. Like the rest of Sydney almost went into lockdown. And so they treat it very differently.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm very thankful to be living here as well, because then I don't really have to worry as much about the virus and all of that. And so that's been good, but I do feel for my family in the US who is struggling. And it also was hard because I had a sister that got married and I've had two nephews born in 2020 that I haven't been able to see.
Sure. That's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of stuff affects everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
But life over there, other than the large events, is pretty normal. They got you guys wearing masks, arrows on the floor, things like that we're used to.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty normal. Even large events, we're starting to do those. Like I had a friend that went to go see the Frozen the other day on Broadway.
The stage, yeah. Stage production.
On stage, yeah. Or like we had a cricket match a couple weeks ago. Because cricket is really big here.
Right.
People are going to Australian Football League matches. Some of the churches are opening as well with masks. But yeah, it's normal-ish.
Yeah.
That's
cool. That's great to hear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you guys handled it so well.
Well, I was gonna say you can't compare.
Right.
Well, I'm thankful.
We won't compare. I won't tell you how many.
Yeah.
Worst thing a day.
All I can say is during lockdown, I was going to the beach three days a week.
Well, now the interview over. That's just. Well, we are almost out of time here. In our last few minutes, I'd love to hear, because we talked quite a bit about Paris and France and kind of compared that to your life here in Canby. But I would love to. I've never been to Australia. I'd love to hear just more about what it's like over there, what Sydney is like, weird slang that you've learned, funny stories, things like.
Oh, yeah.
You see kangaroos all the time. Kangaroos. I just have lots of questions about kangaroos. So,
I don't think I've seen a kangaroo in the zoo.
Okay.
I don't think I've seen one in the wild.
The zoo here too, so that's not different.
Yeah, no, but they're a thing, definitely. I haven't really. Maybe I have. I'm trying to think. I think I've maybe seen them on the side of the road when you're driving. They're kind of like deer. Like you have to avoid them when you're driving at night, sort of thing. Life here, I love it. It's honestly, I feel like I was born to be here because if you look at Australian culture, it's actually a combination between American culture and European culture.
Right.
And because I've lived both in Europe and the US, I feel moving here was very much like a natural thing for me.
Yeah.
So I actually have a funny story. I wouldn't have been able to tell you this story until last week, but
oh, God,
I get this question all the time about spiders. Yeah. And like, so are there spiders there, Jamie? And I'm like, guys, no, it's fine. Like, I don't see spiders. I don't see snakes.
Well, there's lots of things that can kill you out there, right?
Lots of spiders. Yeah,
that are venomous.
Yeah, there are. It's not really that big of a deal. It's more like if you're out in the bush, you need to worry about it. But in the city.
Like in the grocery store, they're like hanging from the ceilings. But just in on that continent, well, there are lots of things.
On that note, though, so in Australia, we hang our clothes up on the line mostly. Mm-hmm. Like we have dryers, but we don't really use them because of electricity and all that. So there's a spider. There's multiple spiders that live on the line where I hang up my clothes.
Okay.
And I got my clothes off the line last week, and I was actually on the phone with my sisters. And I unraveled my jeans, and there was a massive spider. Like a massive, like the size, I don't know, like how would you, the size of
like a silver dollar she's doing.
Yeah, the size of a silver dollar, like this massive spider living like in my, it was like sitting in my pants, and I freaked out.
You weren't wearing, yeah.
That I wasn't wearing, yes. I freaked out. And I like didn't know what to do. And I was on the phone with my sisters and I was like, what do I do? And they were like, Jamie, get a broom. No, I didn't kill it. I ended up grabbing my pants and throwing them outside. And I was screaming at the set this whole time. I was like hyperventilating. And I was like, there's a spider. And
why people in other countries don't like Americans. We're screaming. We're throwing our pants out onto the street. Give us a bad name, Jamie.
Yeah, well, I got it. I ended up getting it off and calming down and stuff. But yeah, that was not pleasant. And then another time I actually found a nest, a spider nest. Is that what they're called? A spider nest?
Yeah.
On my towel. They had like built a spider nest on my towel.
Yeah.
That I had hung up.
that's no good. And then you have, they're smaller, but there are a lot more of them at that point.
Yeah.
The baby spider.
Trying to think of lingo.
My wife and I lived in Missouri, and I think they have tarantulas there. I think that if you had told me that, asked me where tarantulas lived before we moved there, I would have said like only the rainforest. Like I had no idea that they even lived in like maybe Arizona and like the rainforest. I had no idea that they were in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And we came home, we were living in an apartment. We just came home from like school and work one day. And I swear, Jamie, our landlord was out there he was like fighting it with a broom. Like it was like lion or something. And we saw this like huge thing, you know, on the grass and, you know, it looked like a tarantula. But we had never seen one in real life before. So like, did this thing escape from the zoo or from like some type of lab? Like what's going on? But it was very normal to him to kill kill spiders with a broom, I guess, in Missouri. That's so we've had similar experiences, I guess. Have you seen any tarantulas out there?
No, I haven't seen any tarantulas. Nope. Okay. That was like my big spider experience in Australia. But it's really not that bad. It's like my first one and I'm moving house anyway. So we'll have to deal with the spiders.
Yeah. Soon. Yeah. Yeah. Have you made lots of friends at school?
Well, so I started university, which we call uni, mm-hmm. back to the lingo. So I started uni last year, beginning of last year in March or February. So we went straight online like 3 weeks after class started. Yeah. So I've actually made more friends with the staff members at my university due to this award. And I also work at a different university in Sydney. So I'm working at one, studying at the other. So I've probably primarily made friends. I go to a church here, or I was going to a church before COVID. Made a lot of friends through there and through work as well. Not as much uni because I'm studying IT and none of us like to talk to people like anyone. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like we're just tech nerds, like coding and building IT systems.
Right. Right. right? Humans are way more confusing than computers.
Yeah, exactly. Why would you want to talk to people?
Well, we have really enjoyed talking to you, Jamie. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for making this happen. I think this might be our record for longest distance interview, so that's cool.
Usually, that's awesome.
Yeah, usually we're interviewing people that, you know, live down the street. So this is cool. Before you go, is there anything else you want to add? Do you want to shout out where people can find Chronic Hope, follow you on Instagram, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so people can find Chronic Hope through our website, which is www.chronichope.org, Instagram at chronic_hope, and then Facebook, just type in Chronic Hope. You'll be able to find it. Yeah, and it'd be great if anyone could follow, sign up to our newsletter. We have some cool projects coming up that are really going to be helpful for the community. And so I'd love for you guys to get involved.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, again, Jamie, thanks so much. Congratulations on your success out there.
Thanks for having me.
Your adventures, and we'll be sure to stay in touch.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, just bummed. Miss going to the Wild Hair. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Canby in Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. Now Hear This, Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This, Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.